Good evening, and welcome to Off the Bookshelf Radio. This is your host, Deborah Herman. Each week, we bring you either guests talking about publishing, we talk about writing, we talk about book marketing, and this evening, we have a special guest. Diane O'Connell is a former acquisitions editor. She's now an independent editor, and she's going to share some of the secrets that are in the minds of the editor. So this is also a live call-in show. You can call in after 20 minutes past the hour at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. If you have any questions you've ever wanted to ask an actual live editor about what they look for, how to get published, how to write, how to improve your writing, now is your chance, because Diane O'Connell, who is also my friend, is sitting right next to me in my studio. How are you, Diane?
I am great. We just had a great dinner together.
Yes, it was too awesome.
At a nice Greek restaurant. And I'm up here visiting. I usually come up to your neck of the woods about once a month when I come here to look for some peace and quiet from my New York office to prepare for a client.
I know. This is where you can get work done. And I'm wondering, why don't I get work done?
Well,
I guess it's because I'm
going
to have to come to New York. I know, because I live here. It's like too quiet. But yeah, so it's great when I get to see you. We inspire each other, and I learned so much from you. You've really worked, is it primarily in the fiction area? You were an in-house editor. I know that you've done both, but I'm always particularly interested in talking to you about fiction.
Well, I've actually about 50-50 fiction and nonfiction. When I was an editor at Random House, I would say the majority of the books that I worked on and acquired were fiction. But since leaving Random House, and I had a career for a while as an author and writer, I concentrated mostly in the area of nonfiction, wrote 5 nonfiction books, 200 magazine articles, and then over the years kind of worked my way back to fiction, which is really my true love.
Holy moly, that's a lot of magazine articles and books.
I got pretty burned out after a while, especially with the magazine articles. And I found I got to a point where really what I wanted to do was help other authors write their books instead of writing my own.
Well, and it's fun to be in the editorial chair, because if you have a love of books, which I know we both do, I can imagine that you like book sales as much as I do. Do you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I know. It's like my people. When you love books, it's sometimes a real joy to look at something when you know what can make it better.
It really is. And that's, to me, the real joy of my work, is when I look at something and I can see either something that's almost there, but it just needs that few extra pieces of ingredients to make it really work, or something that's really at the beginning stages and how I can help develop that story there.
Yeah, because a lot of writers are discouraged because they may even be premature in trying to get their work published, because that seems to be the goal. That's the end game. But there are so many steps in between in bringing a book to life and to make it so that it can compete in the marketplace. So in what I love about you is that instead of looking at something and saying, well, that's just, you know, hey, go get another job, you know, you look at it with the eye of the author and the eye of the editor to see, okay, this is your voice, this is your project, how can we make this sing? So you're really giving birth.
Absolutely.
You know, helping them, like a midwife.
You're a midwife. That's the term. I ran into somebody yesterday on my way up. And it's funny.
Like in your car?
No, on my stop. I stop in
I was going to say, this is going to take this conversation in a whole new direction.
No, I have this place where I stop off for lunch, always on my trip up in Millerton, New York.
Love Millerton. They have like a great store there that's been there for 100 years.
Great bookstore. Yeah. And there's this wonderful old diner. And I sit at the counter and invariably I meet people and strike up a conversation. And lo and behold, I struck up a conversation with a woman who is a budding author. And we were talking about her book and about what I do, and those were the exact words she used. She says, "Oh, you're a midwife."
Yeah.
I love that idea.
Yeah, because, you know, people wouldn't some people, I guess, do this. They insist that their babies are born on a certain day and they want to have a cesarean. And, you know, the doctors are saying to them, no, that's really not a great idea because the baby is not going to be healthy if you do that. And I think it's the same thing with books. Sometimes writers want to push the gestation period too fast because they're so anxious to give birth and to send it on its way.
That's such a great analogy. Pushing the gestation period. I'm going to use it.
You can use that. You're my friend. I get everything I have, you have.
That's the biggest mistake that I find that authors make is they are in a rush to get published. And with my nonfiction authors especially, often they will choose an arbitrary date.
Yeah.
And it's always much sooner than you could ever possibly get something out. And the trouble is that once you've published it, once it's out there, that's it. You can't take it back.
No, that's not completely true.
What
I'm saying, and this is completely a digression for just one second, is the good news is if you self-publish certain books, you can pull them.
That's true. But we don't want to do that. We don't want to encourage people to go down that path. But yeah, the point is that I see often authors making very superficial changes to their manuscript when I'm giving them suggestions on what they really need to do or some really deep revisions to it. And they need to sit with it and spend time with it, take their time, let it gestate. And I know I'm in trouble when an author, if they've gone through the route of just having a critique letter and they come back to me 3 months later and say, it's done, I fixed it.
I know.
Then I know they're in a rush, you know. And good writing takes time.
Well, and they may not know what it needs. And that's another reason I think, that Off the Bookshelf, the name of the show, is really also based on the self-publishing website that I'm launching. But I've been in traditional publishing for 20 years. And I think no matter what you're doing, you need to create, have a writer's mindset and so that you know what you're supposed to do. Now, what I want to make sure we cover tonight, because we could talk about so many things, is when you were an acquisitions editor in a traditional publishing house, before I say that, I want to state that whether it's traditional or non-traditional publishing, your book needs to be of a certain level because it has to compete in the marketplace. So having an acquisitions editor here who was at Random House, we can get a keen insight into what you looked at, because what you were doing was making essentially buying decisions on behalf of your company. You had a bottom line.
Absolutely.
You had to pick good stuff.
Well, you know, a publisher, it's not only that. What authors need to understand is that it costs the publisher a lot of money to get your book to the marketplace.
Yeah.
So it costs a publisher about $80,000 to get that book out there in terms of, you know, the overhead, the support staff, the sales, the marketing, all of that. And so a publisher, you know, we don't like to think of it this way. You know, we like to think, well, a good book will be out there. We authors don't like to think of it that way.
Yeah. We're artists.
Right. We artists like to think, well, if it's a good book, it'll be published. But in the end, it really has to be a bottom line decision.
On the part of the acquisitions editor
right.
and the publisher.
So we are looking for, you know, where this book is going to fit in the marketplace. We are looking to see, is this book original or is it derivative? You know, if it's original, it stands a better chance of standing out in the marketplace. It's a given. Is it well written? I mean, obviously, it has to be well written. And the interesting thing about the way the publishing industry has changed since I was at Random House back in the 80s is that at that time, it was very possible for a rough around the edges author to send in something that would land in the slush pile. You know, it was an unsolicited manuscript, and an editor on staff could, you know, lower end editor could read it, like it, and offer a small advance and actually take on a budding author and develop them into become a real good professional author. But those days are over because of all the conglomeration of the publishing companies. There are a lot fewer editors left on staff. The editors who are on staff are really almost strictly acquisitions editors. And that means they are looking for stuff to go pretty much out of the gate.
Yeah, so I guess some of what would have happened with the, I guess, lower echelon or newbie editors is that they would develop, almost educate the new authors, help them pay their dues and refine themselves. So I guess perhaps that's why a lot of this has to be done outside of that arena before you go ahead and try to get published. You know, there's all these other opportunities to educate yourself, such as working with a developmental and I guess that's what you would be called now, independent editor, on WayNet, Writers, Agents, and Editors Network. We've created that forum so that you can meet other writers and do the types of things that you would do if you had someone taking you under their wing, because they're not going to do that anymore.
Right. Well, that's how I cut my teeth in editing, was taking on the slush pile and finding the gold in the dross and developing authors there.
How did you learn, first of all, how did you learn what was good, and how did you learn how to teach those budding authors how to improve their manuscripts, or did you do it for them? So it's sort of a three-part question.
How did I learn what was good? A lot of reading.
Okay.
A lot of reading. I knew what was selling in the marketplace. I knew what the publisher was looking for. I also have a background in college, in English lit and creative writing and journalism.
We have we do have our first caller. I will get back to that. Chloe, you are joining us from Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I am.
How are you tonight?
I'm fine, dear. Hoping you're the same. I'm
you're
a little late
great.
Getting on here, but it's been another busy day for me.
Well, tell us what you would like to know, or ask us what you would like to know.
Well, it's my understanding that you're speaking mostly about what agents look for. Am I correct on that?
Well, tonight, now I come from a literary agent slash author editor background, but our advantage this evening is that we have as my special guest, Diane O'Connell, who has spent many years as an acquisitions editor within a traditional publishing house, Random House, and is now an independent editor. So we're trying to pick her brain and find out what it's like from her point of view and what she looked for when she was in that position.
Well, the reason I ask is, you know, I've pretty much given up on trying to contact acquisition people and agents, and I went ahead and, you know, did independent publishing. And basically, I now have four books on the market, and haven't done great, but, you know, it's been good. And I'm also a contributing author for another book that's coming out in about another month or so. So I'm not sure that, you know, I'll be getting too much out of what you're going to be talking about, but I could be wrong. I'm always willing to learn something new.
There are always many things to learn. If you want to increase your visibility as an author, if you have any questions about the craft, a lot of times self-published authors cross over into the traditional arena, and there are some advantages there. Now, do you write fiction or nonfiction?
I have both. As a matter of fact, my novel won an award in the Reader's Favorite competition for fiction, and it's been written into a screenplay as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I don't know if it'll ever get made into a movie, but the screenwriter, thinks it's good stuff, and he's quite interested in pursuing it and making contacts and all of that. And two of them are nonfiction, and one is a children's book. The one that just came out in December is a children's book.
Well,
so I've done a little bit of everything.
Suggest, if you have a question for us, it sounds like you're well on your way. Just let us know. But my recommendation for you is to share your experience over at WayNet, which is WAENet.com. We love having a community of writers, particularly those who are, trailblazing in the self-publishing arena. And the off-the-bookshelf community would welcome you. That's a self-publishing environment, and there may be some more places for you to sell your book and market your book. We're doing You can listen to the archives of our show. 2 weeks ago, we talked about marketing, and we'll talk about that again.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Well, I'd like to listen in at least for a little bit. And we'll take it from there.
Well, you are going to love the show. Keep listening and following. And I'm sure at some point there are some things that you can also learn or share.
Sounds like a plan.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you, Chloe.
Thank you, Chloe.
Thank you.
So I guess people, Chloe's comment really brings up a question that I always have is, should people just, I guess our answer is no, but should they give up on traditional publishing? Can they break through, and what do they have to do to break through? Like today's world.
In today's world, you have to rise to the top. You have to be really, really, really good for a publisher to want you. Not almost there. Not this has potential. But you have to be the cream of the crop. And so what does that mean? What does that entail for an author? That means really honing your craft, really taking your time. If you're writing fiction, it means taking your time to build your characters, to build your story, to have all those elements in place, to have something really original to say, to have the structure in place, the tension, the conflict, all of those things that go into making a great story. And then also to engage the services of a developmental editor who can see your work from a very different viewpoint than you, because authors are just too close to their works. That's why there have always been editors. That's why all actors need directors. You need that sort of dispassionate but interested third party to look at your stuff, to have the big, long view of it, and to know what's working, what's not working, and how to fix what's not working.
Oh, I just got a light bulb over my head. Can you see it? No, it's actually my kitchen. No, I'm just kidding. Interesting. So in the older days, and again, I've been at this for, I'm not going to say, well, all right, at least 20 years. But back in the old, the days of old, you used to have more contact with developmental editors. You used to have line editors. I mean, still, they have to proof a book, but they're choosing the cream of the crop. And now I think some people, if they hire, so they have to kind of recreate what they would have gotten if they were a marginal or less experienced new writer they have to recreate it
exactly.
in order to rise to the top.
Well, that's the thing. Whether you decide to traditionally publish or self-publish, you need to become an author entrepreneur. You need to essentially, as you were saying, recreate that staff around you to help you get that book out there. Because what people don't realize is in traditional publishing, you have all these layers of editing. So the process would have been, or is still, actually the process would have been, there would have been some back and forth with the developmental editor, maybe maybe even three rounds of publishing to get the story sharpened and in shape. Then once the story was in shape, then the book would be sent to a line editor, usually in the past on staff, somebody who would go out and smooth out the prose, sharpen it up, tighten it up, cut out the flab, things like that. Then after that, it would then go on to a copy editor who would take care of all the grammatical, spelling, inconsistencies, syntax, things like that, all the nuts and bolts of the writing. Then after that, after the book is designed professionally, then you would have a proofreader look for all the typos. And often they would go through a couple of rounds of proofing. So you have all these layers of different eyes and different layers of editing going on in-house. For authors who choose to self-publish, one of the mistakes I see is that they write the book, well, it's done. My Aunt Betty loved it. You know, my writer's group said, hey, it's ready to go. And then they go and get it out there, and it's really not ready.
Because they don't have the chance to go through having an unpolished diamond working up the ranks of the publishing house the way they used to. Now,
right.
Now with smaller houses, I think you may have more opportunity to have someone who works directly with you. Maybe they'll massage the book along. But when you're dealing with these conglomerate publishing houses now, it is a much different story. I mean, there are books we would have, as agents, that we would have sold, you know, 5-10 years ago, right away, and we have to jump through more hoops, and that's not even getting into the issue of platform.
Right.
You know, so I don't want to be discouraging. I guess what we're coming up with and why the light bulb went off over my head is that writers today have the opportunity, if they're savvy and if they're willing to, you know, bring in these other players, to be able to create books that are more polished, follow the protocols so that they're taken seriously in the first round.
Right.
With the publishers.
With the publishers, exactly.
Or the agents. They're taken seriously.
Right. And the thing is that if you're working with an independent editor who has connections in the industry, from having been on staff, they often know a number of agents, and they know the right agents to channel the work toward. And I know for my clients who I feel are ready, and that's underlining who are ready, I will make the call to the agent and say, you know, hey, I've got this fantastic author. He's written about such and such. Would you like to take a look? And often they'll say yes, because they know me. They know I've worked with the author. They know I would not be making that call unless I felt that book was worthy of being considered by that agent. And so, you know, that's another way of getting your work seriously considered by an agent.
Now, I think that people ought to recognize that you probably chose to move out of publishing.
Yes.
Out of being an acquisitions editor. On the other hand, there are many highly qualified, talented acquisitions editors who were downsized. So you are my favorite editor, but there are editors out there to work. As many writers as are out there, there are probably editors who are qualified.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, there are going to be even more, I predict, with this merger between Random House and Penguin.
Yes. People that would have been making the decisions you know, they know publishing. They will either become editors or, God bless them if they become agents, because that's a whole different story. But as self-publishing becomes even more popular, the other point I wanted to make is that the self-publishing arena, when handled correctly, meaning being savvy enough to hire an editor, to, you know, to learn about marketing, that's the training ground that used to exist with the slush pile and the younger editors.
Mm-hmm.
You can self-publish and recreate that opportunity to earn your stripes. And some of the books that come up through the ranks that are self-published, that are gaining attention, gain traditional contracts.
In fact, I went to a Writer's Digest conference last year, and there was a publishing panel there, and the editors were saying on the panel that they were seriously looking, trolling for self-published books to see what was doing well.
Absolutely.
And so there is definitely that opportunity there. But again, the caveat, what was doing well. So, you know, there is the, you know, the material has to be good. It has to be professionally presented, you know, right down to not just the editing, but the look of the book. It has to look professional. And then there has to be that marketing component as well. And I want to say something else, even though we're not talking about marketing, but it is so intertwined with the publishing world now, is that, you know, authors, whether you're doing traditional or self-publishing, you still have to pay attention to the marketing end, because the publishing companies for those entry-level authors are not supporting them as much as they used to. So it's really up to you to make your book a success. So that's why I have a lot of authors that I'm working with are saying, well, hey, if I have to, you know, kick in money to hire a publicist, or I have to go out there and do a blog tour and do all this work on my own, why don't I just self-publish, you know, and keep control myself?
Well, there are advantages and disadvantages. A traditional publishing deal still is worth pursuing, especially if you've established yourself as a self-published author, or if you've learned marketing and to create an internet footprint. And we will be spending other shows absolutely again talking about this. You can follow my blog at my website, deborah-herman.com, and it's just my blog because I'm becoming a digital evangelist, essentially. But even with all of that, it's imperative to understand this side of the business and to become, you know, more of an, so I don't want to say that there's no reason to pursue a traditional publishing deal. There's always a reason, but you have to gain these types of skills. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
So, but there's another thing I'd like to talk about with you, because you have so much knowledge. So let's say you were an acquisitions editor today, because I think this is the same consideration that people need to go through when they're even presenting a self-published book. What makes a good book? Let's go back to that question, and then I'm going to ask you to walk us through when you evaluate a manuscript and to give us some clues of how to structure and, you know, and let's talk about fiction. What makes for a good novel?
A great story. And I mean, I know that sounds kind of cliched, but you want to be pulled in. You don't want to be able to predict what's happening. You want those big emotional moments. You want characters that really resonate with you, that are original, that feel like real people, not like like types. You want to have, I think, you know, what I look for is I look for conflict and tension, because that's what will pull the reader through. So one of the biggest mistakes that I see authors making, and then I see time and time again, is it takes them too long to get the story going.
I've been accused of that. But of course, that's my husband saying that. He says, well, you get to the point already.
My husband does that too.
Here we are, and we're, you know, we're writers. I think we're going to have to evaluate whether we fit the structure when we talk. So talk more about that.
Right. Well, what I see happening, and it's funny that, you know, especially like writers of thrillers will often append a prologue to the story, which is really interesting, really intriguing, really fun, something, you know, happens, you go, wow, this is going to be great. And then you have maybe 50 to 100 pages of exposition setting everything up. You know, so I find that what the problem that authors have is, where do they start the story? Where does the story actually start? And how much is backstory in exposition? And
now, what exactly does exposition mean?
Well,
our non-Dianes.
Okay, so you have you have backstory, which is everything that happened in the past to your characters or in the situation. Exposition is often explaining either a technical thing, like if you're writing working on a spy thriller, a technical thriller, or let's say if it has to do with a legal thriller. And, you know, there's some legal proceedings, so it's explaining what happens. It's explaining. That's what
exposition is. Explaining, okay.
Explaining.
Okay. And boy, you can get bogged down in the splaining. I know that.
And it is.
And the details.
Absolutely. And it's inherently undramatic and inherently, you know, no tension there. And so, you know, the trick is, to bring in backstory and to bring in exposition and description and all those other things in a way that actually pushes the story forward. So those are the things that I look at. But what I find is that authors often like they front loaded what we call in the industry an info dump.
So if there's too much description and too much detail, is that an info dump? If there's nothing actually happening?
Well, that's the thing. You can have wonderful description. You can have wonderful detail if it's in the service of story. So if there's an underlying tension there, it's the words that the author chooses to use. Is this description setting in place some foreshadowing to what will happen later? Is this description reflecting on what this character is feeling at the moment or where this character has been? So when you're doing all these things in service to the character and to the story so that it's fully integrated and not just a piece apart, then it moves the story forward.
Yeah, because sometimes I get like bogged down with things that are just, yeah, it's an interesting tidbit. But I remember years ago reading a John Truby screenplay book or something like that. And I remember learning about something called cigarette action, where he described that if there's a cigarette burning in an ashtray, it sure as heck has to follow up, and that has to be what set off the trigger or something.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? And I know that's true in a screenplay. Like if they pan in and show you that there's an ashtray with a burning cigarette, that later on it's going to be the clue. But I think when people are writing fiction, they don't always match things up. They put a lot of extra stuff in there.
Well, they put it in because they have fun doing it and they like it. And they're attached to it, you know, but it's not in service to the story. And so it's the editor's job to look at that and saying that's not serving the story well, and to get the author to either part with it or to reframe it so that it is in service to the story.
Yeah, because it may be that it's useful somewhere else. It's sometimes it reads just too much in a row. You know, where, wow, I was enjoying that. And then, you know, so for me, a lot of times when I'm reading, I like to do what I call just a first read on people's books. I don't claim to really, especially for fiction. Now, nonfiction, I've written many nonfiction books, but for fiction, it's more a visceral reaction. And it's more like, wow, I want to stop reading this now. You know? I'm bored, and I have, you know, I don't have a long attention span, or I feel very engaged, and there, and I love having my emotions played with, where I can't figure it out, and where the writer suddenly makes me want to cry, you
right.
know, and I don't even know why.
But the author,
but
is
the author
very
knows.
Carefully constructed for that to happen.
Yeah. Even if they don't know. I mean, sometimes I do think authors write from instinct. And
they call them pantsers.
Is that what it is?
There's a term for it. It's actually called pantsers.
What is that?
Meaning they write by the seat of the pants.
Oh!
Stephen James, who I absolutely adore, and he writes these wonderful thrillers, a terrific human being. He proudly calls himself a pantser. But I can tell you from having read his novels that he may call himself that, but he knows damn well what he's doing. And
yeah,
he's got it worked out.
It's like an
out.
Instinct.
He knows the structure. He knows the points to hit. He knows what to avoid. And he knows how to build a good story. But, you know, that probably took many, 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 you know, years and years of honing.
Of pantsing.
That, of pantsing.
So I want to remind our audience that this is a live call-in show. You have a real live editor here at 888-627-6008. 888-627-6008. In the future, I'm absolutely going to bring you back to talk even in more detail about craft.
Ah.
Because I would love for some of our listeners to be able to gain that second nature instinct so that when they're writing, they're going to have in the back of their mind, wow, I just spent 3 pages writing this detail that I love, and it's poetic, but there's no action. It's not going anywhere. There's no connection to character.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're becoming sensitized to what makes a good story. And of course, reading is a wonderful way to do that. But I think even reading a great deal, we're not always reading things that are great.
Right. So you have to read the greats, you know? And you have to read with purpose. And I also tell people when they, you know, I teach a course on mastering point of view. I, you know, teach a course on writing a novel from the ground up. But one of the things with point of view is a mistake that I see happening over and over again, like head hopping. Right. So, you know, we're literally you will dip into the mind of one character and then to another and then to another. And it's all over the place. And invariably, Or they'll start off with, you know, writing it in the first person and suddenly switch to the third person.
Oh, my gosh.
And they'll say, I've had students say to me, but James Patterson does that.
I don't think so.
Yeah, in some of his later novels.
Oh. But I love James.
But, you know, the thing
is, early stuff,
you
want to
look at the early stuff. And I say always, don't pay attention to what James Patterson or any of these people are doing now, because they are brand names. People are not buying the story. They're buying a James Patterson book. Take a look at what they did, what their first book was.
When they were working really hard to make it perfect.
Right, when they had to sell that first book.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when they had to establish themselves as an author. And you will see most likely more of those literary rules adhered to in the earlier stuff.
Yeah, people can rest on their laurels a bit. He knows how to write a great story, but I've edited work where I've had literally in the same paragraph, I thought I was losing my mind. It was one of my first big editing jobs. And in the same paragraph, point of view shift.
Oh, God.
And I think it's because they started first person and then changed their mind and mm-hmm. then didn't make the change throughout the book. But it was a long book.
Oh.
It was hard to do. And I don't have as – I'm more of a pantser when I edit things. But certainly there are rules and there are techniques, and I would love – to bring you back to focus on some specifics for people if you would be willing to do that.
Absolutely.
Because it's just wonderful. And we can so help people improve their skills. I always tell people, if you really want to be a writer, then really do what you can, learn what you can. And it's not even about paying dues. It's about education. You wouldn't just wake up one day and say, oh, I'm finished with this job. I've retired. I think I'll be a brain surgeon. You know, there's a learning curve.
Some of my best clients.
But nobody will die unless you write that.
Right. But some of my best clients are people who are, you know, they're in like the second chapter of their lives. They have established, you know, these wonderful careers. They're a little older, you know, like maybe in their 50s or 60s and looking ahead to
That's
the next
not
chapter.
Older.
No, I said a little older.
Oh, I'm going to smack you.
They're not babies anymore.
I'm going to smack you. That's because we have more to say.
That's why I'm saying there's some of my best clients, and they say, you know what? I want to learn. Bring a lifetime of experience, and they know that things take time, and they're not in a rush. And I always tell people it's not where you start.
Yeah.
It's where you finish. It's how much work you are willing to put in to learn the craft, you know, read great writing books. And I can talk about some of my favorite books on learning the craft. I don't know.
Sure. Let's mention some now.
Okay. My favorite all time right now that I'm reading is The Fire in Fiction by Donald Moss.
The Fire in Fiction.
Brilliant book.
I have known Donald Moss for years when he was first starting out as a literary agent, and he knows his stuff. He's also a very nice person. So I didn't know about his book. I'm thrilled. I'm going to have to read it.
He also has another one called Writing the Breakout Novel, which is wonderful because it's filled with a lot of exercises that you can do.
Well, I vouch
to learn
for
the
that.
Craft.
I vouch for those books.
And Story by Robert McKee. Now,
okay.
Robert McKee is the screenwriting guru, but he's all about structure. So his book is just industry standard, but you can apply it to absolutely every work of fiction in terms of how to structure a story to keep the tension going. I love Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, which is just for inspiration. You know, she talks about the importance of being allowed to write a shitty first draft.
Oh, I love that. And does she use the word shitty?
She uses the word shitty.
Oh,
yeah.
I like her too.
But she really talks about the process of writing, becoming a writing. I love On Writing by Stephen King.
Yes. That I think was a surprising book for people to learn more about his process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, certainly I don't want to get too far into his brain because I think most of my nightmares have been after watching Stephen King movies, but I can't, but it's sort of like, you know, you have to watch them, but no, I can't watch them, but no, I have to watch this. No, I can't watch this. It's too scary. No, but yeah, that's great. Now, what I think we might want to do is I'm going to be reposting an MP3 of this podcast on my blog at deborah-herman.com. And I can just hear my daughter teasing me. I don't know why I always emphasize the dot. It's always .com. deborah-herman.com. Either way you prefer. We'll be posting it, and I'll ask Diane to give me a list of those wonderful books, and I'll provide links for you to purchase them, and also a link to Diane's website as well and where you can reach her. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. We still have some time for the show, so you'll know where to reach her, and I'm going to be bringing her back as a regular guest so that we can talk about the craft of writing, because you have so many opportunities now as writers to write books, even though some of the delivery systems are changing, publishing is changing, writing isn't changing, And writers aren't changing. We have a calling, we have a mission, we have a passion. And so you need to learn how to express it in a way that will be received by your reader and will perhaps lead to a sale. So what else would you like to say?
Well, let's see, what else would I like to say? We're talking about the craft. I want to talk a little. We've been talking
we're getting close to the end of the hour, but we have about 5-10 minutes.
Well, we've talked up till now mostly about fiction, but I also want to talk a little bit about nonfiction, because a lot of the people that I work with are solo practitioners or business entrepreneurs who are looking to take their business to the next level. And so they're looking to brand themselves with a book, essentially. So one of the things, if you happen to fall into that category where you either, have something that you want to say and you want to launch a business around that. I have a number of my clients who actually launched businesses with a book. Or you happen to be, let's say, a life coach or a therapist or a nutritionist or a fitness coach, whatever, and you want to bring a little bit more attention to your business, you want to stand out in your field, writing a book is a great way to go. And in many cases, self-publishing is the ideal way to go for that, because you can get that book out there much quicker.
Yeah, in your time.
Yeah.
Because publishing is still, no matter what, it's a year behind is when it gets through all the processes. We're running up into the end of the hour, but I do, you gave me an idea. I think we'll do a show called Brand Yourself with a Book.
Yeah, and that's because there's a lot there in terms of how to write the right book.
Absolutely. Let's do a whole show on that. I'm going to be going back to Rutgers for a second session on digital marketing. This one is focused on social media marketing, and I know my brain is going to expand so big. I'm going to need a new size hat if I wore one, because every time I go, it's like I don't know if I could fill myself with one more ounce of information, but we're going to focus on utilizing that information for book marketing and helping people to become writer entrepreneurs. So I'm going to give you my contact information, and then, of course, I'm going to allow Diane to tell you where to reach her. You can always find me at waenetwork.com. That's the Writers, Agents, and Editors Network. It's a wonderful social network for writers, agents, and editors where you can have a 24/7 virtual cocktail party. There's groups, there's forums, there's contests, everything you could possibly want. You can reach me on Twitter at DigitalDeborah, where I will be posting everything that I learn about digital marketing and publishing. You can also find me at my website, which is deborah-herman.com, and it is being changed to reflect some new things. So you can also listen to Off the Bookshelf Radio every week, same time, Mondays, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and it is a product of the Off the Bookshelf website. That's offthebookshelf.com, a self-publishing website and community. Diane, you are an independent editor, consultant, book coach extraordinaire. How can people reach you?
Okay, my website is www.writetosellyourbook.com, and that's write as in W-R-I-T-E. writetosellyourbook.com. And if you come to my site, I have a very robust blog with lots of articles on craft and publishing tips and things like that. I also have a free special report called 50 Ways to Avoid the Rejection Pile. And so that's loaded with lots and lots of tips, writing tips, but also things that acquisitions editors and agents will look for, and solutions to, you know, avoid that rejection slip. So if you go to my website, you can sign up for the free special report, and that'll also put you on my newsletter list. And I send out a newsletter every other week. And so you'll keep up to date with blog posts, with industry news, with quick tips. Anytime, you know, if I have a show with Deborah, you know, I'll let you know then.
We will absolutely let each other know, because I'm going to be combining the WayNet and Off the Bookshelf radio newsletters. And I will also give you a link to Diane O'Connell's website, because her information is prime. We are now at the end of our hour. I want to say goodnight for another episode of Off the Bookshelf Radio. It's been wonderful talking to you about writing and publishing. We both want to encourage you to continue writing. Don't give up. We just have to stay ahead of the curve.
Right? That's right. Never stop writing.
Never stop writing. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thanks for having me, Deborah.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you.